My name's Kip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. I ain't had a drink all day long. Didn't hurt nobody today. Didn't hurt myself. I worked all week, paid my way. Every night coming home up the street, all the neighbors wave at me with all five fingers. Might not impress you, but I didn't even realize people could live like that, you know? I've been here before, and I'll talk about that later. But my home group is called Robber's Roost. No, not really. We're about 100 guys. Most of us are all ex-convicts. We got over 500 years in prison amongst us. And we're trying to learn how to be gentlemen. We're trying to learn how to be fathers, how to be husbands, how to be employees, how to be a neighbor, how to be a member of society. And we put great emphasis on what's going on outside of the meeting, not so much what you're saying inside of the meeting. You know, talk's cheap. My sobriety date's May 12th, 1984. And it would have been May 12th, 1994 if I could have hung in there. I don't know about y'all, I love liquor, man. Oh, Lord. Besides women, that was one of God's greatest ideas. They both got me in a lot of trouble. My father's Irish and Sioux, and my mother's Irish and Choctaw. And my father liked to drink, and my mother liked to fight. You know the way it was in my house, you'd be waiting around and get later and later. My mother, you could always tell we had hardwood floors, and you could always tell my mom by the way she was walking. And pretty soon she was marching. And when she was marching, someone was in deep. And she starts marching, and it's getting later and later and later, and me and my brother were going, uh-oh. You know, and pretty soon, you hear this old pickup coming up the road, bouncing off the curbs. And if you look out the windows right about that time, you see all the neighbors grabbing their lawn chairs and trying to get a good seat. And, Daddy would slide sideways in on the front lawn, you know, and Mom would fly out that back front door with a butcher knife, go for the driver's door, he'd bail out the passenger door. And the neighbors were all cheering. And that was just Monday night, you know? Should have been there on holidays. It was, ain't none of that made me no alcoholic, though. You know, I can't blame any of that on my daddy. If anything in the world, my dad taught me exactly what alcohol will do to a man, what it'll do to a family, what it'll do to children, what it'll do to a career. I had no illusions about alcohol. I wanted nothing to do with it. You know, I don't blame him. I blame the San Diego Unified School District. They had this great idea. It was time to start teaching the young people of San Diego about that stuff we don't talk about in A&A. And they took us into this big hall, and they showed us this movie. Had these two lames come up and tell us all about their experience, the tragedy with this particular green vegetable matter. And they turned the lights on, dismissed us, and I hit my buddy Balto in the ribs. I said, Balto, can you get some of that? And he says, yeah, my dad smokes that stuff. I said, well, cool, man. Hook me up. And I met him the next day. I said, you get it? He goes, yeah. He says, meet me after school. So we hooked up after school. I said, so what do? He says, well, we got to go boost some wine. I want some wine. Why? He goes, I don't know. But my dad always drinks real cheap wine with this stuff. You know, we didn't want to make no mistakes, you know. We went down this little market, and I boosted a short dog, a sweet red port, and he got a little bottle of Muscatel. We went down this canyon. He fired that funny little cigarette up and took a hit off of it. He handed it to me, and I took a hit, and I started coughing, man, and I'm looking at this stuff, and pulled off that fancy screw cap. Took a pull on her, you know, and it hit my belly and it jumped right out, you know, and landed on my shoes. And I ain't no quitter. Took another pull, and you got to do that yo-yo thing, you know, pinch your nose. And you finally get down there, then you take another little pull, and it starts going down. The time I got done, man, it was just going down smooth. It had such a wonderful bouquet. I don't know what that means, but I... And I looked at my Balto, and he's sitting there, and he's sucking on this little tiny cigarette, you know, and he says... I go, no. I said, you're going to drink that? And he says, no, man, this stuff's vile. And I said, can I have it? He says, knock yourself out. Well, I drank his. I don't know what alcohol did for y'all. Alcohol was the most incredible thing that ever happened to me in my life. Alcohol saved my life. You know, I was born in I lived in a neighborhood. It was all first-generation Hispanic. Nobody spoke English. Everybody had dark brown skin, dark brown hair, dark brown eyes. My cousins live with me. They're Indians. And they all have dark brown skin, dark brown hair, dark brown eyes. And I was, only thing me and my brother Bill got was the Irish, you know? And we were white-skinned, freckles, blue-eyed, and towheads, you know? We went outside of that house, and Mexicans wanted to beat our ass. We went in the house, the Indians wanted to beat our ass, you know? And we knew we were different right from the start. I grew up around a lot of violence, an awful lot of violence from the very beginning of my life. And it was just part of my life. And I walked around in absolute terror, but I wasn't even aware of it. It was just the norm. And that morning when I drank that alcohol, I laid down and I looked up at the sky. And I experienced my very first spiritual awakening. You know, I knew all about the first three steps, Alcoholics Anonymous, long time before I ever heard of you. You know, when I was 11 years old, I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was powerless over this world. And I knew my life was unmanageable. And I drank this magic stuff that was more powerful than anything in this world. And I immediately turned my will and life over to it, and I never looked back. I laid there that morning, and for the first time in my life, I wasn't afraid of anything in the world. My skin fit. I was a whole human being. I knew I had a right to be here. And I fell head over heels in love. I'd never known you could feel like that. It wasn't, you know, me and my brother, we used to have this theory that, you know, at one time or another, there were some aliens that landed on this planet, were having a picnic. And we wandered off, and these crazy Indians stole us, you know? And we figured that whatever atmosphere it was, it had alcohol in the atmosphere from the planet we come from. You know, because when I drank that alcohol, man, it was like, this is what's been missing. And I drank every chance I could get. When you're 11 years old, that isn't a lot. You know, there ain't no liquor in my house because as soon as it comes in, my mom's wrestling my dad for it and pouring it down the sink or hiding. He had it hidden so well we couldn't find it, you know, but we drank every chance we could. And when I was 14 years old, I got expelled from the San Diego Unified School District for hitting a teacher for the second time. And that was a misunderstanding. I got here on a lot of bad breaks and misunderstandings. He misunderstood who I was. I came home, my mom was standing at the door, man. The school called, ratted me out. She's standing there with this little bag of green vegetable matter. She said, "What's this?" I said, "It's probably just what you think it is." And she said, "Get off my property." You know, I've been waiting for her to tell me that since I was 5. You know, and I split instantly. And I went over to a friend of mine's house. He says, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't know." This is about 1964. He says, "Check it out, man. All these people are going up to San Francisco, and all they do up there is get high and listen to music and make love." When I was 14 years old, music was on my mind 24/7. I got up to San Francisco, and I'll share in a very general way with that. I've always been grateful to the God of my understanding that I'm not allergic to penicillin. They had some great music up there. Lots of it. I found out I didn't fit in here either, you know. I grew hair pretty good back then. But I'm a fighter, you know, and these people were all pacifists. Someone would say something to me, I'd knock them out, you know, and I see something I want, I just take it. And, you know, I just didn't quite fit in with these people. And I found out what my true calling was. I'm a capitalist pig. Still am. And all I saw was opportunity, you know. All my friends come from Mexico. They want this product that comes from Mexico. They're willing to pay anything to get it. I couldn't even believe it. They gave it away where I came from, you know. And I called my buddy Balto. I said, "Balto, you ain't gonna believe this." And he said, "No." And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Come on down." And me and Balto went to Mexico. And we talked to his family down there, and we started a business. And I was in that business for most of my adult life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I a lot of things I don't share from the podium. I was arrested in Mexico when I was 16 with 200 kilos of this product, and I was sentenced to 25 years in prison at La Mesa Federal Penitentiary. And when I was 16 years old, I had real long blonde hair and blue eyes and couldn't grow no whiskers yet and weighed about 90 pounds probably, you know. And they took me in that prison. It's one of the most incredible prisons you've ever seen in your life. Sounds kind of scary, huh? Balto's family ran that prison. There was people waiting for me when I got there, and I got my PhD in that institution. And I learned how to survive, and I learned what willing to go to any length means. I love Mexico. You know, it's a very civilized country. You know, it works on the principle of mordida. And that just means a little bite. And what that means is if you've got the right amount of money and you know the right person, you can walk from anything, even if it was on live television, you know. And Balto's family knew that I was worth a lot more to them outside than I was inside. And after a few years, they just paid him off and sent me back to work. And I continued doing what I was doing. You know, I got arrested again. and I was living with this gal, and she was pregnant, and I ended up sitting there for another year in another county jail fighting this case. And I never did find out where that, if the baby was born or what. Nobody called, nobody sent me any letters. When I got out, I couldn't find her, and I wondered about that for a long time. You know, and I ran into this little girl, and young girl, she was only 15 years old, you know, and her family had a lot of money. And anybody here ever go to jail for being stupid in public? Two guys raised their hand. Right. The rest of you was bad breaks on misunderstandings. This company called Roar came out with this product, and you've heard of it. I'd just do the stupidest things in the world, man, right in front of God and everybody, and they'd just lock my ass up, you know. And this gal, I got busted 3 times in 1 week, and she, every time I'd just get to my bunk, man, they'd say, "Roll up, someone's bailed you out." And I'm going, "What?" And I get my clothes, get dressed out again, get down, there's a little girl, she's standing on there. And the last time I said, "How come you keep bailing me out of jail?" And she looked at me with big brown eyes and said, "Well, what else should I do?" I married her. Yeah, I married her right away. And I like a woman that thinks like that. Me and Kathy was the greatest crime partner I've ever had in my life. I mean, me and her were in gunfights, and she had my back. I couldn't even tell you everything me and her went through, and she always had my back. And I got busted. I did another in a year and a half in another institution, and I got out, and I had this real unreasonable parole officer. And he wanted me to get a job. I don't do that stuff, you know. And you know, I just got my case transferred. If anyone's on parole and you want to get out of the state and get another one, talk to me after the meeting. I'll tell you how to do it. I got my case transferred up to Oregon, and I get this parole officer. He's driving a Volkswagen bus with flowers on it, you know. He's got long hair, and he says, "Hey, man." And I go, "Yeah." He says, "Hey, you know, just keep it cool and call me once in a while." I said, "No problem." And I never saw him again, you know. That's the way I like to do parole, you know. And for a couple of years, you know, we found out that my wife was pregnant. And you know what? My heart of hearts, when I got right down to it, what I'd always dreamed about, more important than anything, I'd always wanted to be a father. I'd always wanted to have a family. And I got real excited about that. One day, I started working. I got out of what I was doing, and I went to work in the woods and started logging. And then I started working on commercial fishing boats, and I fell in love with that way of life. And one day she says, "We're going to the hospital." I went to this hospital down in North Bend, Oregon. And I sat in this room, and after a while they came out and they brought this little boy. And they put this little boy in my arms. And I had my second spiritual awakening. Something happened to me that moment that I didn't even know was humanly possible. And that was that I experienced absolute, total, unconditional love for another human being. And I looked at that boy, I started crying, man, my heart exploded in my chest. And I promised him, I said, "Man, you're gonna be my pal. Me and you're gonna have fun. You ain't gonna have to be afraid of nothing or worry about nothing." And I meant it with everything I had. You know, it was a couple years later, I'm at another hospital, and they brought out this little girl, and they put this little girl in my arms. And exactly the same thing happened, you know. I felt just head over heels in love. My heart exploded in my chest, and I held that girl, and I promised her. I promised her with every fiber of my being that, you know, that she would never have to live in fear. Nothing would ever happen. She would have everything. And I meant it with everything I had. You know, I got off parole right after that. Well, my wife wanted to go back to California, so we went back down here. And things were tight, man. There wasn't, I couldn't make the kind of money I made up there, and I ended up drifting back into what I've always done. Except things were going real fast this time, and I was making a lot of money. I made a lot of money, and I bought a big place, and I set it up for my kids. And it was just a park for kids, man. We had a fishing hole, we had streams, we had every kind of gym toy you can think of, and all the kids in the neighborhood was there, and me and my brother and my wife and my kids, and that was our compound. And my life was sweet. All my time I spent with my kids. You know, I got them up in the morning, I bathed them. You know, I taught them how to talk, I made their breakfast, I played with them all day. You know, taught them all how to play dominoes and spades by the time they were three, you know. You go to jail, you got to be able to make a living somehow, you know. And it was that one of the best parts of my life. You know, and at this period of my life, alcohol and drugs were not a problem. I picked and chose whenever I wanted to. I was always very careful with alcohol. Alcohol, right from the very beginning, was very unpredictable to me. You never knew exactly what was going to happen, you know? But I could pick and choose when I wanted to do it, and I was very cautious about it. September 6th of 1976, my wife and daughter were out going to school clothes shopping. School was getting ready to start, and me and my son were out in the yard. We were playing Frisbee. My brother was gone. It was just me and my son there, and a guy came over, and he brought some good smoke over, and we smoked it, and I was thirsty. I wanted a cold beer, and I went in the house, didn't have any. And the guy had left, and the only thing I had was my bike there, and I told my son, I said, you know, stay here. I'll be right back. I'm just going to run up the street and get a six-pack. And I got on my bike, and I rode up. Got a six-pack, came right back, and when I got there, the police were in front of my house and the fire department, and all the neighbors were running, and my son had chased me out of the driveway, and he'd been run over by a pickup truck. And when I got to him, his head was split open, and I could see his brains and bones were protruding out of his chest, and a big piece of me died. And I sat in an intensive care with that little boy for the next 6 months in a coma. And I don't know nothing about God. Nobody ever took me to church, you know. My dad knew his last name, is all I knew, you know. But I cried out to this God, you know, you give me back my son. I'll do anything if you give me back my son. You know, and my son, he did survive. His body survived after about a year. And he was 27 major brain surgeries later, and he was he never got past the age of about 4 years old, mentally or emotionally, and he couldn't talk and he couldn't hear. And he had a lot of other problems. And this is when alcohol started changing for me, the guilt that I felt for that. You know, the guilt I carried with that was incredible. You know, I've got out of that. My brother had gotten real sick, Bill. Me and my brother, Bill, we were only 11 months apart, and we backed each other's play all of our lives. Anything I've told you, my brother was right beside me. You know, I told Bill, I said, Bill, I got to make some money, man. These hospital bills are killing me. And he said, yeah. But he got real sick right after that. And, you know, my family had him committed to a hospital, and he had a disease called schizophrenia and had a complete break. And he called me from that hospital after a while, and he said, get me out of here, man. And I said, are you all right? He said, yeah, get me out of here. Do whatever you got to do. Get me out of here. And I did. I went against the family, the doctors, and everybody, but I got my brother out of there, and I brought him home. And I came, and I told him, I said, I got to go, man. I got to go to New York. I got to go put something together real fast here and make some money. He said, you better not go. And I don't know. I don't feel right. And I said, you know what, man? I got to do this. You know the deal. Just watch the kids, you know, and I'll be back. And I gave him some money. You know, money's fixed everything all my life. And I got in this cab, and I looked at my brother, and he was holding my little girl's hand, and he was crying. And I've never seen my brother cry before. And I got back, and this thing that was only supposed to take a few days, these Yankees can confuse anything, you know. And it took 3 weeks to finish this deal. And I got back home, and my daughter was there, and I said, "Where's my brother?" She goes, "I haven't seen him." And I said, "What?" And I said, "You haven't seen him since when?" "Since about 3 days after you left." And that was real odd, man. And I went back. I said, "Let's go out." He had a mobile home right across the creek from my house. We went over there, and I knew it before I got there. But I opened the door. My brother's head fell out of that trailer house. And 3 days after I had left, he'd blown his head off, and there was just a pile of maggots laying in that doorway, and his head was looking up at me. And a big part of me completely snapped. You know, and I don't tell you this because I want your sympathy or I want your pity or I'm trying to impress you, you know. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in chapter 5, they read it every single week, and a lot of people don't really understand. It says that those among us that got here with grave emotional and mental disorders. And I'll tell you, when my brother's head fell out of that trailer and hit my foot, my psyche completely snapped. It was like a branch breaking. And I separated from reality. And I'll tell you this, that I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. I thank God that alcohol does for me what it does. Because alcohol takes away, instantly takes away the guilt. It instantly gets rid of those pictures that are burned on the very front of my brain. It allows me to lay down and get a little bit of rest at night. And it stops the screaming in the morning. If it wouldn't have been for alcohol, I would have joined my brother a long time ago. But, you know, first time I came to A&A and I heard y'all read those promises, I thought you were talking about liquor. I don't know what alcohol did for you, but every one of those promises come true for me every time I took a drink, you know. Can I get my water, please? Thank you. You know, things started going pretty quick, and the people I worked for, the family I worked for, don't mess with drunks. They're very unreliable. Anything can happen. And I got cut loose from that, and I couldn't make any money, and I couldn't stop drinking. And my wife, you know, she was going through her own pain, Kathy, and I wasn't paying no attention to her because I'm absolutely, totally selfish and self-centered, and it was my brother and it was my son, you know, and she might have been the mother and the sister-in-law, but, you know, she had no idea how I felt, you know, and I ain't giving her nothing. And some other guy was, and she left with him, and, you know, and I didn't blame her. But she left me with this little girl. My son was in this special hospital, and my little girl was crying. She's scared to death. Her mother's gone, her brother's gone, her uncle's gone, and, you know, her dad's acting nuts. And she was sitting on my lap, and she was crying, and she was getting hysterical. What's going to happen to me? And I got her all calmed down, and I told her, I said, "Honey, we don't need nobody." So we just hit a bump in the road, and I'm going to catch my breath here in a minute. We'll be all right. And I got her calmed down, and I put her to bed. And about that time, this fella knocked on my door, and he came in. He brought in this magic stuff, man. I don't know if y'all heard of it here, but California, we call it Mad Dog 2020. Mad Dog 2020, for you that don't know, is an event drink. Something memorial will happen every time you drink it. For all you new guys, maybe you're thinking you're being a little bit too hard on yourself, get you some Mad Dog. It'll run your rusty ass back in here so quick you won't even know what happened. Drank this Mad Dog 2020, and the next thing I know, this lady is tapping me on the shoulder, and she says, "Excuse me, sir, you have to get off the airplane." I was in my living room the last I checked, you know, and I open my eyes, and my little girl's sound asleep next to me, and I'm on this big jet. It's completely empty except for me and this lady, and she's looking at me very perturbed and saying, "Sir, you have to get off the plane." And I said, "Where am I?" She said, "You're in Fort Lauderdale." I said, "Florida?" She goes, "Yeah." I said, "I hate Fort Lauderdale." She goes, "I don't know nothing about that." She goes, "You got to get off the plane." And I'm looking up my daughter, you know, I mean, she's five. She probably knows what's going on. And you don't want to arouse any suspicion, though. So, you know, you just say, "We're here." She looks out the window and she goes, "Oh, goody." And I keep waiting for something, and she doesn't give me nothing, you know? So you got to act like you got it together. And I said, "Come on, let's go." And we got off the plane, and I just kept acting like I knew what I was doing. And I found out I had plenty of money, and I called a cab, and I did what anyone would have done. You know, I said, "Stop at a liquor store and take me to a hotel. I got to figure out what's happened here." And my next conscious thought, I came to, and I was butt naked, and I was in four-point restraints in this green room, and I thought I might have missed something really cool for just a second, you know? And it was a misunderstanding. Apparently, I'd run into this young couple at this hotel here in Fort Lauderdale, and they had this Floridian additive, man, that you could really drink with. And they were drinking Jack, I was drinking tequila. We drank their liquor, we drank my liquor, we drank, went through all their additive, man, and I was still thirsty, and they were still thirsty. I said, "Y'all ever heard of Mad Dog 2020? I felt like a missionary, you know, and we went and got us a jug of Mad Dog, and allegedly, the next morning, it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm down in the lobby of this nice hotel, butt naked, trying to introduce myself to this young lady. Now, California, that ain't no big deal, you know? You people back here are pretty Bible Belt or something. You're pretty uptight about stuff like that, you know? And they call the cops. I went completely nuts on the cops. They didn't know what to do, and they maced me and beat the hell out of me. They took me to jail, and the jail didn't want me, and they took me to county mental health, and they gave me a geese of Thorazine and calmed my butt right down. And I come to, and I get to talk. I don't know where my daughter is. I haven't got a clue. And I said, "Is this still Fort Lauderdale?" And they go, "Yeah." And I go, "Oh, that's good." And I go talk to this doctor, and I said, "You know, I've been through all this trauma and everything, and I hope I didn't do anything too bad. But, you know, if you let me out of here, I'll be out of this state today. I guarantee you, before the sun sets, I'll be out of your state." And he goes, "Good, get out of here." You know, and I walk out. I don't know where my kid is. You know, they give me my clothes. I walk out the front door of the county mental health building, and there's my little girl with this young couple walking up. And my girl, she runs up and jumps in my arms. And I said, "Come on, baby, we're getting out of Florida. I told you this place sucks." You know, that was 31 years ago. First time I've been back. When they first invited me, I thought it might be one of those sting things, you know? When I go into a blackout, anything's possible, you know? And all the guys I sponsor, they all have criminal minds. And I said, "Well, I'm going to Fort Lauderdale." And they go, "Wait a minute. It's a trap, Kip." You know, so I thought about it long and hard. He said, "I'll call you back," and I go, "You know, I don't know." Had my lawyer call back here and check things out first, you know. Some of them law enforcement agencies can carry a resentment for a long time. I'd love to tell you that was the end, but that was only the beginning of a very tragic story, and I ain't going to tell you all of it because we ain't got time. I'll tell you this, that for the next couple of years, me and my little girl, we traveled all through the South. We went to Georgia, we went to Alabama, we went to Arkansas, we went to Oklahoma. And everywhere I lived, I fell into the same thing, and the same thing happened. Same thing happened, only worse. I promised her I'd get her in school, I'd get a job, I'd do this. I don't ever do anything like that, man. I find a softer and easier way, man. I'm attracted to a certain way of living, and, man, I can see people in the game a mile away. And anywhere I went, I just get right back into what I was doing. And every place I left on a dead run. Last place I left was in Atlanta, Georgia, at midnight on a bus. And I'm going into Oklahoma. And I met this good Christian young man in there, and he was sitting by us. My daughter started talking to him, and he starts talking. He was a real nice young man. And he said, you know what? He says, I'll tell you what. He says, my family, we got a big place in Oklahoma. And you know, you can come out on the ranch and you can work for my daddy. You know, we got a couple guys out there. We got a little house you and your daughter could live in. We'll get her in school. We'll help you get your life back together. And I said, my little girl was so excited. She's going, come on, Dad, come on. I'm going, well, and he goes, the only thing, you can't drink. I went, whoa. And I said, okay, because my little girl wanted to. And I wanted to be a good father so bad. And I went back, and I sure enough, they were the nicest people in the world. God, they were nice people. And they took us in and set this little house up for us. And I went to work for this guy, and I didn't drink, man. And I'm going, oh, God, I was sick. And it's hot, and I don't like to work. And especially when it's hot, you know, and I worked out there. I did it for a whole week, and I didn't drink, and I didn't. Hey, it's a long time. 7 days without a drink in a row, you know, and I got paid, and the guy I was worked with, he says, hey, I'm going to town, cash my check. You want to come with me? I'll buy you a beer. I said, let's get out of here, man. And we went into town, and I don't have to tell you what happened. You know, I got back in late that night, had blood on my clothes, and it wasn't mine. And I walked in that place, and my little girl was sitting there waiting for me, and she knew. I walked in there, and her eyes dropped, and she just saw me, and I changed clothes. And she grabbed her raggedy old doll in a pillowcase, threw some stuff in it. I grabbed a few things. We stole that man's pickup truck and ran down to the bus station. I got a bottle of wine and 2 tickets to California, and I got on that bus and drank my wine and passed out. We come to an Albuquerque, New Mexico, and my little girl, she's rocking back and forth, and she's crying. When I come to, I said, what's the matter? She said, Daddy, you ain't fed me. I'm so hungry. I said, as soon as we stop, I'll get you something to eat. And we went down this little liquor store, and we pulled 19. There's always a good liquor store right next to every bus station in the United States, you know. And I went in this little liquor store in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I got her a sandwich, and I got me a bottle of wine because I was sick, and I got up to pay for it, and I only had enough money for one or the other. And I had to put her sandwich back. And you know, I've done a lot of things that you'll never hear me talk about from the podium. I've never done anything in my life that shamed me more than that moment. Shamed me while I was doing it. And I got on that bus, and I couldn't look at her. I just walked past her on the bus, and she just sat there, you know. And thank God there was an angel on that bus. There was an elderly black lady that was sitting there, and she didn't say a word to me. She looked over at my little girl, and she said, honey, she goes, my daughter made me this big lunch, you know. I hate to ride alone. Would you mind sitting with me? And she took care of my little girl all the way back to California, and God bless that woman wherever she is. And then we got back to California. I did what all heroes do at the end of the road. You know, I went to Mom's house. I told you a little bit about my mom. My mom, I take care of her today. She has Alzheimer's, and she's my girl. And but my mom is the meanest woman I've ever known in my life. I know a lot of Hell's Angels that had a better attitude than she does. I saw her stab my daddy 3 different times, and one time the neighbor was yelling at me, and she snuck up behind him and knocked him cold with a shovel, you know, and you gotta respect a woman like that. I mean, you gotta respect a woman like that, you know? And my mom, I mean, she's a certain look on her face, and she's telling you to do something, yes, best be backing up, going, yes, ma'am. You know, and she opened that door. She hadn't seen me or her granddaughter. And let me tell you, her granddaughter, the sun rose and set on that child. She didn't know if we were dead or alive, man. And she looked at her granddaughter, and she had this raggedy old dress on, holding on to this raggedy old doll. And she had been crying, and she was dirty, and her hair was long and stringy. And she grabbed her granddaughter and pulled her in her house. She put her finger on my chest, almost put it through me, and said, "You know, if you ever come near me or her again, I'll kill you. You get off my property." And thank God she did that, you know. She saved my daughter's life. And I don't even know what happened next, you know. The rest of it's all hearsay. Fortunately for me, there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that were there that have reminded me, you know, that continue to remind me. And I was a wino. I lived in a bamboo patch on Pacific Coast Highway, right on the ocean. Beautiful view. Septic tank drained down into this thing, you know, and nobody would go in there because it smelled so bad. But that was my home. I called it my little condo. And there was a 7-Eleven and a little biker bar right across Pacific Coast Highway, and I could walk over there and panhandle. And I couldn't get no action on the panhandle. I'd stand at that bar door and wait for someone to order a pitcher of beer and go to the bathroom and run in and drink as much of it as I could before they came out and beat the hell out of me, you know. And I mean, I knew what willing to go to length meant a long time before I met you guys, you know. And that's the way I lived, you know. All I know for sure is that I was arrested 52 times on that one corner for drunk in public. Over a three-year period. I know that I was in Tri-City Hospital 11 times, and I was in County Mental Health 13 times over the next three-year period. And everything that happened in between that, I haven't got a clue. You know, I get little bits. You know, I hear a lot of talk about blackouts. I had whiteouts. That's when you come to, and everybody's looking at you, like right now, and you're going. And then it fades to black, and you come to somewhere else. It's a manner of living, you know. And I was standing out in front of the 7-Eleven one morning. I was so sick. I was shaking. I remember that day so crystal clear. I was shaking so bad, man. I know I was ready to go into a seizure, and I couldn't get a drink. It was early in the morning, man, and my body was going insane. And I'm standing at that door, and this guy pulled in. And he's driving this four-door sedan, you know, and he's got this square little wife sitting up front and these square little kids sitting in the back, and he's wearing a suit. And I looked at him with disgust, wondering how he could live like that, you know. But who am I to judge, you know? And the fella got out of that car, and he walked up to me, and he says, "Excuse me, sir." He said, "Will this help you out?" And he gave me $2, and I snatched it out of his hand and damn near knocked him down. And he said, "God bless you." And I ran in that store, and I got me a bottle of wine. And I came back out, and I just chugged it down as fast as I could as soon as I got outside of the store. And I held my face against that glass until the shaking stopped. And I opened my eyes, and I looked in the reflection of that glass, and I could see that family sitting in that car, and they were talking, and they were looking at me, and I knew they were judging me. And I turned around, and I flipped them off, you know, and cursed them. I went back to my bush, and I'm drinking my wine, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, man, I don't know if it was an auditory hallucination or some dummy up on the cliff yelling, but, you know, what I heard was, "Maybe you ought to go to A&A. And I've been to A&A, you know. To all these different jails and institutions, we got a real active fellowship. These dummies were always trying to save me, you know, and I'd patient with them. I'd tell them, "I ain't no alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs." And I believe that, you know. And I don't know how, and I don't know what happened, but friends of mine today were there. I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the back. The meeting had already started. And these guys, walked in and I had a whiteout. And all of a sudden, all these people are looking at me. And there's this guy at a podium, just like I'm here, and he said, "Are you looking for AA?" And I nodded my head. And everyone said, nodded their head. And I said, "Would you like to identify yourself?" I've been drinking wine. around the clock for a long time. I have nothing to do with anybody except the panhandle, you know. And I have lost the ability to communicate, especially if I'm nervous. And if a bunch of squares are looking at me, I get real nervous, you know. And they asked me to identify myself, and I went, and the guy said, welcome, have a seat. Only in AA, you know? Let me give you a little visual here. I've been living in the same clothes for almost 3 years. My hair came down way past my ass. My beard came down past my belly button. I weighed about 110 pounds, and I had a lot of things living on me besides me. You know, and they had told me one time before, they said, come to A&A and we'll love you till you love yourself. I remembered that, and when I walked in, I saw this pretty little girl, and I went and scooted her. I said, we might as well start with her, you know, and man, her eyes just jumped out of her head, man. She ran for her sponsor, and I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to these people, and they're talking about God, and I'm going, oh, man, I see him pass this basket. I know they're going to start singing, you know, and I'm just getting up. I'm hearing people talking. They're giving up stuff, man. You don't tell people that stuff. God, I was so embarrassed for them, you know? This is the lamest thing I've ever seen in my life. I got to get out of here. And there was this lady that kept looking at me from the minute I walked in that room. And she kept smiling at me, you know? And I didn't know what the hell she wanted, you know? But like I said, I got to get out of here, man. I need a drink. And I stood up, and this guy was talking, and this lady stood up. Cut this guy off cold. She said, son. She goes, please don't leave. She goes, I walked in these rooms 27 years ago in Long Beach, California. The cops dropped me off. Told me to go in there. They were tired of arresting me. I walked in the back room and I looked at all these people and they all looked so swell. And I knew when they turned around and saw me and saw what I was, they'd run me off. She goes, I've been on the streets of L.A. since I was 12 years old, and I've done everything a woman had to do to survive out there. And when I saw you good people, I felt dirty. She goes, but a woman grabbed hold of me and brought me in the room. And she hooked me up with this women's group, and they taught me how to be a lady. And she proceeded to talk about 27 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. She came up to all those people who didn't know what to make of me, man. And this little old gal, man, she was in her 80s. She pulled my face down, and she kissed me right on the mouth. The bravest woman I've ever known in my life, man. Let me tell you. And that old gal, she's hugging on my neck. And this is what she said. She's whispering in my ear. She goes, baby. She said, please don't leave. We need you here desperately. You know, people have been beating on me all my life. Ain't nobody ever got a tear out of me. And I'm standing there in front of the PTA, because that's what y'all look like to me, you know? And this old gal's telling me this, and all of a sudden my gut starts rumbling and rocking, and my eyes start soaking wet, and I'm standing there sniveling like a schoolgirl right in front of you guys. And I started coming to A&A. And y'all lied to me right from the very beginning. Told me to just go to meetings and don't drink. You see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a problem drinker. Alcohol is not my problem. It is my solution. And me just not drinking and go to meetings is a death sentence. Because at about 3 days with no alcohol, I don't know why in the world you would want to feel like that. My God, how do you ever go to sleep? How do you stop them? You know, you told me to get a sponsor. I looked at these people. I said, I don't think these people would understand the world I come from. And, you know, and they said, well, you got to do these steps. I looked at those steps. None of those applied to me. Said I was powerless. I've been packing a gun since I was 12 years old. You know, said my life's unmanageable. I like it that way. Mediocrity is my greatest fear. You know, this thing about God, I don't need your God. The things I've done, the things I've seen people do, if there's a God, he certainly has a perverse sense of humor. I don't need your God. Every time I cried out to him, he never cut me no slack. Keep your God. So this other thing, well, you got to make an inventory. I said, what the hell is that? And they go, well, you got to write down everything you've ever done and admit it to another human being. No, I'm not going to tell you a lot, and I haven't told you much, but I am a professional criminal. And I pride myself in no paper trails in any of my activities. Now you want me to write everything down and share it with one of you. I'll guarantee you that's not going to happen. You know, I got to this other one, it's a defect of character. I'm going, what does that have to do with anything? You know, and the guy, I said, what does amends mean? And they told me, and I went, oh my God. I can see now. Loopy, don't shoot. I'm sorry I shot you and your brother and your dogs and took all your shit, but you know, I'm in a spiritual manner of living today. I'm here to make things right. Yeah. I can hardly wait to jump on that one, you know? And that's just one of many, you know? But I'll tell you what, I wanted what you had. I came to ANA, I came to every single meeting I could go to, drunk or sober, and nobody ever turned me away. I went to this one meeting, and I'm going to break this guy's anonymity because I love him so much. His name is Cliff Roach, and he's from Oceanside, California. And Cliff went to that Thursday night workshop right down the street, and his sponsor did, and all the guys he sponsored. It was a wonderful meeting, structured meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd walk in that room every single Thursday night in any condition, and no matter what they were doing, those guys would run up to me and welcome me, never judge me, never have any make any fun or any little cutting remarks. Welcome, Kip. Thank God you made it. Thank God. You know, let me get you a cup of coffee. Come up here and sit with us. And they never try to sell me nothing, never try to do nothing. They would just welcome me in the rooms, you know. And I just lived for that meeting. And I'd come in, and man, and I would stay sober for as long as I could. For the next 3 years, I was in and out, in and out, in and out. In brief periods of sobriety, always followed by a still worse relapse, over and over and over and over. And alcohol finally became the pain. I became willing to start doing some things. I started doing some things, you know, and I got about 4 months sobriety, the very first time I'd had that much sobriety in a long time. And something came up at a New Year's deal at a Christmas. It was a Christmas party, and I got pissed off and went out, and I got drunk and got in a fight with two cops and lost. They cheat, you know, and I come to at Christmas morning butt naked, you know, and hog-tied in a rubber room. They'd busted my face open and been bleeding. My face was stuck to that rubber mat. And I'm trying to peel my face off and look up, and these cops are laughing at me, you know, and I just know Santa ain't coming. And I got out of there. They let me go. I found out, you know, they knew me on a first-name basis. They said, Merry Christmas, get out of here. I made a conscious decision. I ain't going back to AA. Don't work for me, man. God bless you guys, man. I'm glad it works for you. But the only thing, don't lie to me, is liquor. Only thing that takes away the pain is liquor. Only thing that takes away that loneliness, that alcohol loneliness, it would have been a tangible thing. It would have eaten me alive. The only thing that took that away was alcohol. And I'm just going to go drink. That's all I'm going to do. It's the only thing in the world that allows me to live here is a little bit more alcohol. And I had $90. I spent every penny of it on Gallo Port. Still makes my hair thin when I think about how much it looked like. And I cut it up to my little hooch as Maureen had let me move into this back garage room, and I just started drinking. And on January 6th of 1984, I hit the worst spot I've ever been. And it talks about it in A Vision for You. It says there'll come a time where you cannot imagine life with alcohol, and you can't imagine life without it. And if you've been coming to AA for a long time and AA don't work for you, brothers and sisters, the day that alcohol stops working, you're going to know loneliness such as few people can even comprehend. You're going to come to the jumping off spot. You're going to wish for the end. And when I hit that spot, man, I just pulled out my piece, put it up to my heart, and pulled the trigger. And I blew my left lung and two ribs out and knocked me across a room. And I'm sliding down this wall, and there's blood flying everywhere. And the only thought I got is, thank God this nightmare is over with. Let me out of here. And I come to in this hospital. You thought I died, didn't you? Yeah. I told you I ain't no quitter. come to, and there was an old guy in A&A. I hated his guts. He was one of those grateful alcoholics, you know. He always had a suit on and wingtips and that big ugly blue book. And said, I'm a grateful alcoholic. He said, I've been sober so long. I got to A&A. I've been here so long, they only had one A in it, you know. And he's always working with some newcomer, trying to just look good, you know. That's all it was. You know, the guy was a big show, is what I figured. But I hated that son of a gun. He came to me up to a meeting one time, and he got right down dead in my face, and he looked at me, got his nose right up, and he says, you think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid? I looked at him, I said, man, I'm tough enough, old man. Don't you ever doubt that. He got right down in my face. He says, you ain't tough. He says, you're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. And that might make you dangerous, but it sure don't make you tough. And he walked away kind of giggling. I avoided that man like the plague. I go to an A&A meeting, I'd look in all the windows, make sure he wasn't there. When I'm dead, man, and I'm dead and everything is gone, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I hear this deep, gravelly voice. And I've been in a coma for about a week. And I come to and I open my eyes and there's Charlie Tuck standing at the foot of my bed with these two dumb newcomers and their eyes are as big as saucers. And Charlie's standing there looking at me and I knew I'd died, I'd gone to hell, and this is it. Strapped to a gurney with this bold dummy preaching A&A to me, you know, for eternity. Oh, God. No mercy. And I waited for these kids are going to start. I looked at Charlie, and Charlie looked at me, shook his head. He put his arms around these two young men, and he said, fellas, go up there and get close to him, take a look at him. And he went around, and then I said, sniff on him, look at him, look at his eyes. Look at all those tubes coming out of him. Now come back here. And he come back, you know, like little puppies, you know, and put his arm around him. He says, I want you all to pay attention to this. Because this is what happens to an alcoholic who refuses to take the steps. Come on, let's go. And they left. I felt cheap and used, you know. I was in a hospital for right up until the 1st of May. And they let me out. And they gave me all this dope, and they had some money, and I tried to drink. I didn't have the pain, the loneliness, the disgust. I just wanted things to end so bad. Alcohol didn't work. Nothing worked. Nothing took away that loneliness, that hollowness, that hopelessness, that terror. I wanted to die so bad. And I come to on May 12, 1984, the same way I've come to a million times. I come to in the morning, the first thought I have, the first conscious thought is I got to get something in my body, quick. But that this morning was different. I'd been to here so many times, you guys had just rotted my mind, man. Because when I should be thinking about a drink first thing in the morning, what I came to is I came to thinking about the ABCs. It's read at the end of chapter 5 at every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I've been to. It says that I'm an alcoholic. I got paperwork from the state of California classifying me as a chronic alcoholic. At that period of my life, the state of California was in the process of making me a ward of the state for chronic alcoholism. I know I'm an alcoholic. I have no problem with this denial stuff you people talk about. But that's not the question, you see. The question is in my innermost self. What does that mean, that I'm powerless over alcohol? What does that really mean to me? Not to you. Not to my parole officer. Not to my counselor. What does it mean in here to me that I'm powerless over alcohol? And I started thinking, man. And God gave me a vision that morning. He's so gracious to me. He gave me that morning that my daughter was born. And I felt that love. I could see myself holding that child and my heart just exploding with that incredible love, knowing I would have given my life for that child without even a hesitation. And feeling that love. And the next thing just immediately switched to this picture of this pathetic old retrobate walking past this little girl in a ragged dress with a bottle of wine. And I understood what that means. That alcohol, I'm not just powerless over alcohol. I will steal the food out of my child's mouth for another drink. Alcohol owns me body and soul. It tells me where I can go, when I can go, how far I can go, when I can go to bed, and when I gotta get up. Ain't no room for nothing in this world unless it's getting me a drink. And I understood for the first time what that really means. And it scared me, because the next thing said that no human power was going to fix me. I had tried as hard as I could. I tried so hard. If I could have got sobriety by knocking one of you in the head and taking it, believe me, I would have done it. You know. Got to the part I've been dreading since I got here, man. That was that God thing. Started thinking about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had what I wanted. And I ain't talking about their money, their women, or their stuff. I'm talking about a look in their eye and the way they walk on the sunny side of the street, with no matter what's going on in their life. And all these people have one thing in common, because I pay attention. They all talk about this power that is doing for them what they could not do for themselves. In that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, tells me in the very beginning that alcohol is not my dilemma. The lack of power is my dilemma. And the whole purpose of this book is for me to tap into that power, to find that God that is going to restore me. And I got down on my knees that morning and I said the most sincere prayer of my life. I said, you know, I don't know who you are and I don't know what you are, but I give myself to you. And I will do anything that you put in front of me if I don't have to drink today. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I am one of the true, I'm God's favorite child. Right then and there, something happened inside of me that I don't have the vocabulary to tell you. I didn't want to drink. And I got over to Charlie's house, because where else am I going to go? And I knocked on his door, and his St. Edie, a member of Al-Anon, 40-some years, man, she opened the door, and she goes, oh, Kip, Charlie's going to be so excited. You know, you're his favorite. She told everybody that, you know. But I went back there, and that old man, I said, what's up, Kip? I said, Charlie, I don't want to drink. And he goes, yeah, you've been saying that for years. He said, what are you willing to do? I said, I'll do anything. He goes, yeah, we'll see about that. He looked at me and he says, Kip, he says, I got some good news and I got some bad news. Bad news is this, is people like you don't get sober. You die in institutions, you die on the side of the road. They don't even write your name down. You're a badly broken human being. I don't know what that's all about. That's between you and God. The good news is this, I've been here for a while. And I can see that little sparkle deep in your eye. And I know that God has opened the door for you. And I suggest this is the way it's going to have to be for you every day, the rest of your life. One simple fact that absolutely nothing in this world, no woman, no job, no child, no nothing can ever become more important than you doing the things you must do to maintain your sobriety. And that's a hell of a lot more than just going to AA meetings. Are you willing to do that? I said, I'll do anything you tell me to do. He said, follow me. It was on Mother's Day, and we walked over to this park right across the street from his house, and all these families are there having a picnic and stuff. He walks right down the middle of all these people. He drops on his knees. I said, what are you doing? He says, we're going to pray. I said, in front of all these people? He goes, listen, son, the only hope you got is God. If you're embarrassed of God, don't waste his time or mine. He started to get up. I said, wait a minute. And I got down. And that old man took my hands, and he taught me the third step prayer right then and there. He took me back to his house, and I was sick. I'd been drinking, you know, and he detoxed me. Old school, Norm Alpe, 6 hours, tape, reel to reel. Whiskey, Caro syrup, and orange juice. All the men he sponsored sitting with me over and over, telling me their stories for the first 5 days. After 5 days, Charlie comes out, and he says, all right. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. Are you ready? I said, yeah. What do I do? He said, get in the car. I thought that was the first step for the next 8 years. getting the car means a lot more than just getting the car. You know, I got sober going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, sitting on the hump in the back seat, you know, until we got a newer guy and I got to move over and give him the hump, you know. These old timers going up to LA to speak and to carry the message into institutions, and that meeting in the back of that car listening to these old timers talking. You know, and the sponsor, he made me do all kinds of ridiculous things. He says, I want you to get a job. I'm going, whoa, you know. And then he says, and I want you to get an identification in your real name. How did you know? You know, and I never had an identification in my real name. And he made me do all kinds of stupid stuff, you know. He made me be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. I had to get there early. I had to be there before the setup guy to give him a hand. He said, I want you to stand at that doorway and shake hands with everyone that walks in that room. Don't tell them one thing about you unless they ask. Ask them how they are. See, anyone wants something to do in AA, your hand better be the first one in the air, because, buddy, you got nothing coming. You're here by the grace of God, and you better get involved and start rolling and be a part of this deal. You've been a taker all your life. You better start giving. And that's the way it was. And that old man took me through those steps rapidly and thoroughly. You know, in the first 4 months, man, I'm done, and we're moving on. And I'm involved in hospital institutions. I'm in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night. I come up on 90 days. I said, hey, I almost got 90 days. He says, so what? Oh, 90 and 90. He goes, what the hell does that mean? I go, I don't know. Everyone else is saying it. He says, when you find it in the book, give me a call. I said, how long I got to go? He says, until you're ready to drink. I said, I ain't ready to drink. He said, then I'll just keep going. He said, if you find out you maybe want to cut back, why don't you just cut back until you get drunk? And you know, you cut back one too many. So I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day for the first 8 years of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful for the sponsorship I had. He took me, I had to read all the literature, not just the big book. I had to read, pass it on. I had to study that book. I had to study Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, probably one of the most important textbooks we have besides the big book. You know, I had to study Dr. Bob and the old timers. I had to study our history and our legacy and find out what all was everything was about, the steps, the traditions, the concepts, and what everything one of those are all about, so that I could have an opinion in here. He said, unless you know what you're talking about, we don't want to hear from you. You ain't right to an opinion unless you know what you're talking about. You know, and that's the way I was raised in here. You know, I got stuff quick, man. He told me that I get a job. I didn't know how to do anything. I got on my knees, said, God, I'll take whatever you got. Charlie says, I need a trade. Walked out, didn't have a driver's license. A pickup pulled up, said, hey, you want a job? Scared me to death. I said, what is it? I said, it's painting. I said, I don't know how to paint. He says, I'll teach you. I said, okay, and I became a painter. And after a while, I became a very successful painting contractor. And I had about 40 guys working for me, and I became a millionaire very, very quickly. Legally, you know? That's hard. Had the big house, had the boats, had all that stuff, you know? Met this woman, got married. She got sober on the same day with me, and she liked to fish. Now, that's got to be God's will. I'm sponsoring San Diego. I'm speaking all over the world. I got my children back. I was 3 years sober. I got a phone call. That same day, the state of California had given me my driver's license back, which is an hour story in itself, you know? And I came home, and my wife said, you know, there's a phone call for you. And I picked up the phone. This girl, she said, is your name Kip Collins? I said, yeah. She goes, do you know Sandy so-and-so? And I said, boy, a long time ago. She goes, that's my mother. You're my father. And I want to get to meet you. And I want you to meet your grandchildren. And I went, wow. You know, I still came in. You know, the hardest part of this deal has been for me? It ain't learning what's in that book. It's been unlearning what I already knew when I walked in here. I came in here with a lot of old ideas, old school ideas about race, about a lot of different things, you know. She said, I want you to meet your grandchildren. We went out, I met them at a park, and my grandchildren got out of the car. My grandchildren were black. I go, my little granddaughter, she walks up to me. She's got my nose, my eyes, beautiful chocolate skin. She comes up to me. She puts her hips and she looks at me. She goes, you ain't my grandpa. And my father just washed all that nonsense right out of my heart instantly, man, instantly. And I love those babies. You know, I got to make amends to her family and her, that mother, and she came into my life. That little girl that I drug around the world, all over the country. She graduated from the University of Texas, magnum cum laude. She had a master's degree in special education. She works with children like her brother. And one day a man came up to me and said, you know, I need your permission to marry your daughter. I traded that right for a bottle of wine. You know, and you guys gave it back to me. And a little boy that everyone told me to pray that he died. I got involved in all kinds of different things with him, and special education and different institutions and with other men in Alcoholics Anonymous and women Alcoholics Anonymous who had handicapped children that taught me what to do and followed their directions, and I did what they told me to do and watched that little boy graduate from high school at the age of 23 years old with special education, and he walked down in that black cap and gown in my home group. All these outlaws are standing there. You know. And they're just, yay, Davey, you know. And man, he grew up in it. He loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a life I wouldn't trade. I could not believe. How do you get from there to here? You know, I was speaking in Australia, and I went there, and I came back. And I'm looking at my house. I'm looking at my boat. I'm reading, I open up the newspaper, and I'm reading the very front page of a story about a man who broke into a woman's house and raped her in front of her children and cut her to pieces when he was done with her. And it was my daughter. When you're new here, we ask you if you're willing to go to any lengths. If you knew what that means, you'd leave now. What are you really willing to do to stay sober? Are there any conditions? Are there any conditions whatsoever on you being sober? I'll tell you straight up, man, I am absolutely perfectly capable of first-degree murder with absolutely no problem with it if you touch anything of mine. And I went to the hospital. She didn't die, but she lost her face, her breast, and her left arm, and it did not look human. And I want vengeance. I think vengeance is better than Christmas. He's in jail already, and that's perfect because I don't have to touch him. I can have everything taken care of. I can't talk about this. I can't tell anybody anything. I can't show any emotion or pain because all the old ideas just rolled back right on. All the armor snapped back in place. Everything came up. All the shields came up because I ain't going to feel this, and I'm getting ready to do what I do. And I'm looking in that book, and I ain't looking for no way out. I'm looking for a loophole. You know, and anyone here got a little resentment they're having trouble with? I've gone over it with a fine-tooth comb, forwards and backwards with three dictionaries. And all it says is this: for me to harbor these kind of feelings will cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, which is my Father. And if I get cut off from God, the insanity will return, and I'll drink. Are you willing to do anything to not drink again? When you say anything, that's a real big. Are you willing to get down on your knees and pray for a man that does that to your daughter? and to beg God to give him everything out of life you want? See, I am. And I did. I'm telling you that I forgive him. I'm working on that. It's been a while. He's out of prison. He lives over a mile from me. And I ain't going to say nothing because I know the way God works with me. I'll end up having to sponsor him. You know? I'll do it if that's what you want. I'm not going to say I won't. Point is, I did that, you know, the insanity went away, and I was able to go talk to other men. I told them what I was planning. I got that all out, you know. I told them how I felt. I cried like a little schoolgirl for the very first time in front of other men. I cried because it tore my heart out. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the resources and the money to take care of my grandchildren and get her the medical and psychological help they all needed. And I did that. And when my daughter needed a father, I was there. I was there when she needed me the most in her life. And that's because of you guys. You know, you taught me how to be a father. You taught me how to be a grandfather. You taught me, I already know how to be an executioner. I didn't know how to do all that other stuff, man, to walk through it with dignity. You know, I got through that. Right after that, they told me I had cancer and they're going to cut my lips off. I like my lips. Right where they are. You know, and I had to go through, I went through my doctor, my sponsor, and I went through several different doctors, and I went through a very radical plastic surgery, a great doctor, Dr. Asher in California, and I did it with absolutely no medication whatsoever. And I'm not telling anyone what to do with your medicine. You do anything you want to do with it. But I was going through emotional pain, and I told that doctor, I said, if you block this emotional pain that I'm going through, I'll never be able to stop. And he goes, you can't do it. Your lips are all nerves. I said, you'd be surprised what I can do. And, you know, and we did that surgery, and it was radical, man. And I did with no dignity whatsoever. I sniveled and cried and begged. But all the guys that I sponsor came to my house and took care of me and laughed at me, made fun of me, and loved me and took care of me, and I didn't have to take their dope. You do anything you want to do with your dope, you know. I don't play no games. You see, I burned up most of my brain cells on cheap liquor and dope. The only thing I know that's absolutely for certain is no matter what I got to do to stay sober, it's easier to stay sober than to get sober again. That's all I know for sure, you know. Right after that, I came home. My wife was crying. I loved this woman. Oh, God, I loved her. And she was crying. I said, what's wrong? She goes, I can't do this no more. I'm going to drink. I said, do what? She goes, Kip, I'm a lesbian. And I'm in love with Chrissy, and I have to leave. Or I'm going to drink. I didn't think she was going to say that. I said, you're a what? I've joined the Catholic Church in this period of time, and I'm not here to talk about religion, but I love my faith. And one of my greatest mentors was a sober member, a priest, Father Bill Wilson, with his name, you know. And he's gone to the big meeting, but he was a sober priest for over 28 years from Ireland. He was a great, great man. And I went over to the church, and we're both Catholic, so allegedly, I'm going for advice. Actually, I'm going for next communication, you know. I'm going to go rat her out to God, and the priest will take care of her. And I go over there, I'm telling Father Bill this. He goes, oh, my God, oh, Kip, oh, oh, you must feel like life has screwed you square in the ass. I said, yeah, Father, that's exactly what it feels like. I said, so what do you think? He says, I think you make me sick. Because you're always talking about that book. You ever read it? I go, what are you talking about? Oh, this, maybe let's think about, let's try page 61. You know that guy that thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he did everything just right? You keep telling me what a good father you were, what a great husband, that you did this, that you did that. Did you do it? Because let's try page 61. You know that guy that thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he did everything just right? You keep telling me what a good father you were, what a great husband, that you did this, that you did that. Did you do it because you loved her? Or did you do it because you were trying to manipulate and now you feel like you got ripped off? Why are you even telling me that stuff? And he goes, you have no, the first, next page, the bottom paragraph is one of the keys that says, for you to do any of this, the first requirement is you got to stop playing God. That includes your wife. You're not in charge of her sexuality. You have enough problem with your own, you know? And I said, so what do I do? He says, she's a good woman. You go give her anything she wants. Give her a divorce. And I did, and she took my boat. Man, it was a nice boat, too. But she kept my last name, Anna. And she tells everyone she's my sister. And she is my sister. She is my sister. And I learned something in here. I learned what real love is. You know, I learned what real, because I love her. I love her today. I guarantee you I do. But alcohol, I was able to just change it, you know? Our marriage was never based on sex to begin with. It was based on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she has her needs, I have mine. She's sober. She's doing well, so am I. Right after that, you know, my son got real sick. And he died in my arms. And this is when I got the promises. And this is, says that we will know serenity. And I'm going to tell you what serenity is. It's not a beautiful sunset with a beautiful woman in a pocket full of money, although that is very nice. Serenity is having a relationship with a God that is so tangible, so real, that you can watch your child, you can watch everything you care leave and change and die, and you can hurt more than you knew any human being could possibly hurt. But at exactly the same time, know without a shadow of a doubt that God's in charge of all of this, and he don't make no mistakes. And you see, I have that. And I got down on my knees and I thanked the God of my understanding that you guys got to teach me how to be the kind of father I dreamed about being the day that boy was. That I got to have the relationship with that child the way I dreamed when he was born and long before he was born. And you guys taught me how to do that. You know, and I got up and I came home. And all the guys at my house that I sponsor about 45 men, and they were all at my house, you know. And Scotty, this guy I sponsored for years, he goes, listen, this new guy you're sponsoring, he just keeps calling. He just won't give up. I said, I don't want to talk to anyone, man. He goes, listen. He called. He's here. He's on the phone again. He says, tell him something. So I'm sitting there, and the guy says, Kip, he says, we got to talk. I said, Dennis, listen, man, my son just died in my arms about an hour ago. I'm really screwed up, man. I don't know what. He goes, listen, that's too bad. I'm real sorry. He says, but this is really important. We are so self-centered. And thank God for that phone call. Because I got angry for a minute, and I immediately get an inventory, you know. And I went, you're right, my son doesn't need me no more. God didn't make no mistake. My primary purpose is to carry the message to not drink alcohol. And anytime anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I am responsible. Doesn't matter what's going on in my life. My sobriety is given to me by the grace of God, conditional upon certain conditions that I do. I'm going to tell you all this straight up. I got the best life in the whole world. Everything in my life has changed since I walked in these rooms, except my sobriety date. You know, I went to school. I only had a seventh, eighth grade education. I got a degree. Became very successful in a very professional manner or something else, in industrial psychology. And I created a lot of businesses, and I made a lot of money. And I started with, you know, 10 years ago, I was bankrupt, had the clothes on my back. My sponsor told me to stay away from women. I said, you know, I'm the kind of guy I need to be in a relationship. He said, it's impossible for an alcoholic to be in a relationship if they need to be in one. That is not a relationship. You have nothing to offer a woman until you don't need a woman to validate you as a man. You know? And I went, whoa. And he goes, yeah. I said, can I date? He said, keep it light. No sleepovers. He says, I want you to go to school and get an education. And that's what I did, you know. And one woman took advantage of me. I'm weak. Shames me to tell you that. But, you know, I was sitting there one day, and I'd finished school. I graduated, everything in my life. My house, I got a little tiny little house, you know, and my pickup and my dog and all my boots are polished. Man, I got a pot of beans going, a sheet of cornbread, watching a game, me and my dog sitting there. And this gal calls, she goes, Kip, you've been alone a long time. I said, yeah, I have. She goes, I was thinking about that. Why don't you come on over, man? I'll make you dinner. Maybe we can mess around. I went, whoa. See, I'm very flattered, but, you know, I'm watching a game, and I got some beans going and a sheet of cornbread in the oven. Maybe we could take a rain check. And she hung up on me, you know? And I went, wow, God, that's what Charlie was talking about. Now, I think you women are just absolutely phenomenal. But I don't need you, you know? I don't need you. I am a whole human being without any woman, you know? I like my company, and I don't have to compromise it for anything, you know? And I went, this is what he was talking about. Thank you, Father. I said, but you know, if it be your will. You learn how to be a lawyer talking to God here, but you got to be careful, man. I said, if it be your will, I would love to experience true love one more time in my life. But if not, that's cool. 2 weeks later, I'm getting ready to go speak that night and down in San Diego, and I get a phone call. It was this girl who took advantage of me the year before. And, you know, with her mother, I said, what's going on? She goes, well, she got drunk. She got in a car wreck. She got massive brain damage. I said, God, what can I do to help? She goes, you can come and pick up your daughter. I said, my daughter? I'm thinking of my, and she goes, no. You have a 3-month-old daughter. You didn't know that? I went, no. She goes, well, I'm not raising any more kids. What do you want to do with it? I said, where do you live? She goes, Burbank. I said, give me an address. And she gave me the address. And man, I jumped in my car and I drove it about 110 miles from me. I got up there, knocked on this apartment door. This lady, she goes, are you Kip? I said, yeah. She goes, okay. And she hands me this manila envelope, a diaper bag, and a bassinet. Says, good luck. And I look at this little girl, she looked up at me and grinned, and my heart exploded in my chest, and I fell head over heels in love. And her name is Nanu Nanu, you know? All the guys said, you gotta get a blood test, make sure that's your baby. I said, no, 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 no. God gave me this baby. She's my baby. She needs a daddy. I need a baby. I need someone to love, man, you know, and I've never found out. I don't know. I don't care, you know, but I got everything done legally and taken care of and everything, you know, and it was just me and her for a couple of years. And one time a woman asked if she could hold her one night, and I said, you know how to hold a baby? And she goes, yeah. And me and this gal have been on a lot of committees, and, you know, ended up, well, we started dating, and dating, not having sex. Dating, you know, getting to know each other and going to talk and getting, you know, about what we wanted out of life, and found out that we had the same goals. She's just a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we got married. And 12 years ago, I went and cut the cord on a little boy. And his name is Will Casey. And he's 12 years old today. You know, and my little girl, Nanu, she's 14 years old today. And I own my own home. It's paid for. You know, and I just built a big giant addition that I paid cash for. And that don't mean anything. I'm just talking about the opportunities what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. You know, my business is designed around my children. I take my children to school every single day. We get up and pray every morning together. I pick them up at school. You know, I'm homeschooling my son because he's had a little bit of problems in school. And I'm just doing it at home, you know, because they're my investment, you know. I have a life I wouldn't trade to anybody. There's not one human being in the world that I would rather be. you know, and I owe that to you. My message to you is this, that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is outlined in the first 164 pages. Will work for absolutely anybody, anywhere, under any circumstances. I don't care what you've done or what you haven't done. Miracles happen in here. I call it magic. I call it absolute magic. You can take an animal like me. And I'm not any big deal, but I'll tell you, as a result of all you people's help, a strong sponsor, and the God of my understanding, I'm the best human being in every aspect of my life that I've ever been. And I want to thank you for that. That's all I got.